You're listening to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. More people adopted pets during the pandemic, emptying animal rescue centers and straining veterinary care facilities. Pet ownership has actually experienced huge growth in the past 20 years, nearly doubling since 1998. The new book, Pet Nation, the inside story of how companion animals are transforming our homes, culture, and economy, details how pets have gone from the backyard to sleeping on our beds and everywhere in between. And we're joined by the author of that book, Mark Cushing. Mr. Cushing, thank you very much for being with us today. Here's the big question, and I'm just looking at the title of the book. How have animals transformed our homes, culture, and economy?
Probably the better question is, what haven't they changed? The truth is, we've seen a surge in pet ownership. We have watched pets go from, you know, figuratively the backyard into the bedroom and move from kind of a sideshow or accessories in our culture and life. Back when baby boomers were kids, one can think back that long, to center stage now. And That's as dramatic a change as I can think of in American culture the last 20, 25 years. And then what has occurred is a sequel to that was the decision by dog owners in particular, figuratively, to walk out the front door with their dog and take their dogs everywhere in America. So you don't have a listener, I suspect, that's more than a half a block away from a dog somewhere that's walking with their pet parent or in some store or approaching a store, and the list goes on, hospitals, hotels, and so forth. So we've rearranged things so that dogs can be part of our public life. And privately, we have turned pets into this new, not new species. Dogs still chase balls and cats chase string, but, and I always point out that neither cats or dogs ask for this, but they're now in a position within the family. And economically, you know, Pennsylvania is a major state and pays attention to these things. You have the pet economy in the country in 5 years has gone from $75 billion to $110 billion. And Morgan Stanley said it'll be close to $300 billion, more, you know, a threefold increase in just 7 or 8 years. And you see it in every part of the sector. So they're a fixture. It's not a fad. And it's occurred in essentially one and a half generations. And we could talk about, if you have time, you know, how and why that happened.
That's my next question. How and why did it happen?
It happened ultimately because of the human-animal bond, which sounds like an academic term, and it was created by veterinary professors. But it has to do with a simple chemical fact in your brain when you engage with a pet. And there are legion of studies that have proven this. It's not challenged anymore. It was when it first came out decades ago. What's that? When you're with a pet, your oxytocin level in your brain goes up, which is a source of relaxation and calm and basically happiness. And your cortisol level goes down, which is what triggers anxiety, worry, nervousness. And so you physically feel better when you're with pets. So when they came inside 30 or so years ago, and they didn't all march in the same day, but when basically the culture shifted from just leaving your dogs and cats outside to letting them be more a part of your day-to-day life, what happened, of course, was people spent more time with pets and began to really experience that human-animal bond. And it was reinforced, and this is the agent of change more than anything, it was reinforced by the media. At the time, traditional commercial media, movies, TVs, shows, commercials, and stalwarts like Lassie, the greatest dog in the history of the world. You know, on Sunday evenings, when boomers were kids, you know, you watched that show and you saw this amazing animal that was fun, friendly, loyal, brave, just, you know, the best friend you could ever ask for. And then it was reinforced by so many other characters like that. And it led to extraordinary ads in the 1990s that were a pivot point. Subaru and Nissan, you know, Japanese manufacturers, ran ads. And all they showed was a car heading down a California coastal highway with an open window and a golden retriever in the passenger seat, hair flowing in the wind, smiling. And they didn't tell you a thing about the car. Not a thing. And I'm sure the executives wondered what the ad agency was thinking about. And they had a very clear idea. They wanted you to associate a dog with that brand. And they knew the goodwill that a dog would create. And today, if you watch a football game on the weekend, probably 40, if not 50% of the ads have a pet in it. And it's not because it's amusing. It's because they know that the association with pets produces a positive goodwill. So, you know, that was kind of the template. And then what pushed everything, you know, to stay with sports metaphors, kind of over the goal line was what? It was social media in the hands of pet owners and pet parents, smartphones in particular. And it took some of the isolation that digital technology has created in people's lives. I always picture a dinner table with six people and each has their smartphone out texting somebody else who's not at the table, you know, not exactly, you know, a social engagement there. But people took the social media and began to create daily videos and photos and so forth of their pets and built communities across the country, social digital communities. And it broke down some of the isolation and people got tremendous joy. Certainly pets replaced babies as the most frequent subject or feature of photos and social media. And it led to this penetration of dogs in places you'd never think of. And the best example is hospitals. You're next door to New York, which was a state that for the longest time had a law prohibiting dogs in hospitals, but most hospitals 30 years ago, 25 years ago, if you saw a dog in the hallway, somebody would chase it out the door as quickly as they could. Today, you'd be hard pressed to find a hospital in Pennsylvania that did not have animal assisted therapy dogs, where dogs are actually part of the treatment of patients in the hospital. So I'll leave that one example and let you ask another question. But that's about as dramatic a change as you can imagine.
You know, one of the things that we hear most often in public service announcements about, and there are many examples, but that there are too many, an overpopulation of dogs and cats. In your book, you say that there actually is a shortage of dogs the U.S.
Yeah, there's a shortage. There is a myth. There was, in fact, an overpopulation, which turned into a myth after many changes took place that placed dogs into homes and lowered the euthanasia rate, what I call the canine freedom train, where dogs moved from the South, lower Texas, lower Midwest, and the Southwest, and they came up north to shelters. So if people go into Philadelphia to a shelter, they're not getting a stray from Philadelphia that was picked up by animal control. They're getting a dog that probably has a drawl or speaks Spanish in the sense that's coming from a different part of the country. So where we are today with the success of the massive success of spay and neuter campaigns and the logistical network between Southern and Southwest and lower Midwest underserved shelters and big urban shelters in the North, we've got this engine that's producing dogs that are great to adopt up north. And finally, with COVID, it pushed on steroids almost the demand and adoption rate. And we now have shelters. You have pictures of shelters with no dogs. It became common before COVID that if you weren't in a shelter by around noon on Friday, give up any chance of finding a dog that weekend. A lot of this is triggered by a new demographic. What's that? Well, millennials and Gen Zs own 60% of the pets in America, and they have a completely different view and expectations of what should happen with pets. Number one, they want the pets they want. They weren't just willing to go to a shelter and say, whichever dog you have available, I'll take. But secondly, they want healthcare, for example, at the same scale and quality as human healthcare for their pets as themselves. They want to have nutritional choices and all the variety that they want in their life, they want for their pet's life. And you can go down the line and find those examples. So those commercials running at night on cable channels of Sarah McLachlan singing with the jam-packed shelter and the very sad dogs in their kennels, they weren't filmed a year ago. Those are kind of tired and old, and they don't reflect the current situation. So you have pockets of shelters in rural areas, in particular in some urban, where you have a lot of dogs, but that's rare now. And you have a much more efficient system of connecting dogs with willing families from south to north. So it's a challenge. The studies that we've done show the deficit may be as much as 2 million a year, but the Center for Disease Control came out in 2019 and said they think about 1,100,000 dogs come in from foreign sources. They don't come in with medical records or vaccination or veterinary records. So it's not without a price, so to speak. But right now, that's how we make up for it. Pennsylvania, as you know, being in central Pennsylvania, has a strong Amish community. And there are many, many Amish breeders of dogs in Pennsylvania, Indiana, Ohio, as far west as Iowa. That's controversial. A lot of people think if you're a commercial breeder, you by definition are running a puppy mill with abusive conditions, lack of good care and cleanliness and so forth. That's a broad brush that's unfair, but it has had its effect. It's been a wickedly effective epithet to term puppy mill. And you don't know a lot of people that say my son or daughter want to grow up and be dog breeders. I don't think that's a common topic anywhere. So it's a challenge because it takes breeding to produce puppies. They're not raised in labs. So that's an interesting challenge. The greater shortage right now, though, that probably merits more conversation is the shortage of veterinarians, which is acute.
That's one of the things in your book that you address. You say that pet health care is stuck in the 1970s. It has a 1970s model. What do you mean by that, and how can it be changed?
Yeah, great question. Well, the model is kind of a brick and mortar clinic down a road that maybe not a lot of people live on. You drop your dog off for limited procedures. You pick them up later, and that's it. And it was when pets were a sideshow and an accessory, and veterinarians did not see pet owners as demanding very much by way of the care, and they weren't geared up to provide a lot. Between 1978 and 2014, 36 years, fairly significant 36 years in American history, right? One vet school was opened in America. So there was no sense that demand would ever approach the level it's at now. And we simply have too few vets. Baby boomer vets are retiring at about 2,000 veterinarians a year. Pennsylvania has grown since the time UPenn started the vet school. That's the only vet school in Pennsylvania. Lots of states don't have a vet school. And all of a sudden, you have this millennial pet-owning generation, and they want care, and they want a lot of it, and they'll pay for it. And it caught the veterinary profession unprepared. So we just produce too few. Schools' class sizes have grown a little, but not enough. And we don't have any mid-level professionals. In human medicine, we still have shortages. And the Appalachian, Western Pennsylvania experiences this perhaps more acutely than any place in the country. We still have shortages of doctors, but what have we done for 60 years? It's not a recent problem. For 60 years, we produced nurse practitioners at the master's and now doctoral level. We produced physician assistants, DOs, and a wide ladder, if you will, of professionals. And in many communities, there would not be a functional hospital without a PA or a nurse practitioner. Well, on the veterinary side, again, not thinking you needed many more people and kind of an anti-competitive, we don't want new vets threatening our jobs and those traditional worries, which always prove to be foolish, to tell you the truth, but they're still real. Veterinary medicine has 2-year community college degree, vet techs or nurses do a great job, and then it has doctors and nothing in between. And so you now have hospitals in rural, urban, suburban settings, not taking any new patients. You have emergency clinics that are waiting or forcing you to wait 48 hours to be seen, which means you're no longer an emergency clinic. And you have staffs that are burning out, an acute problem, people walking away from the field because the conditions are just too painful. And veterinarians weren't trained to tell people, we can't help you, you know, fix it yourself. And there's been reluctance, and in Philadelphia or Pennsylvania has been mixed on this, to take your location, in the adoption or adaptation of telemedicine, which has been in human medicine for 30 years. It's not an experiment. It's nothing radical. It's used all the time. My wife chairs anatomy at Mayo Clinic here in Arizona, and Mayo Clinic, the Cleveland Clinic, and its locations and other major hospital systems depend upon telehealth and telemedicine, but veterinary medicine has been very reluctant, again, fearful of change and competition. And this is at a time when so many new pet owners, what they want is advice. They want medical advice saying, hey, I'm not a doctor. We have a new puppy. I'm noticing this. Tell me. And guess what? Less than 20% of those situations, a huge amount of data just came out that showed this, less than 20% require you to go into a clinic. But if you can't talk to somebody, what do you think you do? Take your cat, you take your dog, you put them in a car, you drive, you wait in line due to social distancing, and you put so much more stress on the clinic for a condition that didn't require a visit at all. So the solutions are adopt telemedicine, use telemedicine. Don't get rid of clinics, just understand that that's a tool to use to give people information. And millennials in particular, they want to manage their own pet's healthcare. Veterinarians weren't trained in vet school to give a lot of advice. Well, that's what millennials want. You tell me what I should do to manage a healthy, enjoyable life for my new cat or dog, and I'll pay you for it. And that model just needs to be accepted. And the old guard that resists it, millennials are going to get what they want, okay? And they're only in their 20s and 30s, and they're going to run this country for another 30 years, and they're not leaving their pets, they're not going to walk away, and they're not going to turn their smartphones off when it comes to how they manage the pet part of their life. So that plus the mid-level professionals and the first vet school to produce those is coming out next year. You're going to begin to see some changes, but is it quick enough to relieve the stress today? No. And that's, you know, that's what we have to deal with.
We only have about 2 minutes left. I want to thank you very much for being with us today. You know, one of the things that surprises me, though, about what you were talking about, not producing vets, is that how many children did you hear over the years that, oh, when I grow up, I want to be a veterinarian, I want to work with animals, just not happening. In about 90 seconds are left. So what do you see in the future? I mean, is this a trend that is going to continue? Pets are now an integral part of the American family.
Yes, it's not a fad. Millennials own pets at a higher rate than their parents did, Gen Xers or baby boomers. What do you think their kids are going to do? They're going to grow up in families with two and three dogs or cats. That's what they're going to want to have. I got to repeat, it isn't a fad. So their demand's going to grow. Fortunately, a lot of investments are coming into the space to use more technology. The resistance to telemedicine is going to break down. It's going to become more convenient. I'm comfortable with that. You're going to see schools forced to grow, and you're going to see mid-level professionals become much more common, as you see now in so many different medical offices. Everywhere in central Pennsylvania, you'll bump into a nurse practitioner or a PA doing a very good job. And there's just no reason not to have the same thing, because as you say, people want to go to, they want to be in the field. 3,000 American students that are qualified don't get a spot in a vet school every year. So they do something else with their life, and they could be very, you know, high performing veterinarians or vet nurses or mid-levels if they were given the chance. So there's choices to make, but I think you're beginning to get the attention of decision makers, and we will see progress, but it's only going to grow. I'll tell you that much. It will continue to grow.
The book is Pet Nation, the inside story of how companion animals are transforming our homes, culture, and economy. Mark Cushing, thank you very much for being with us today.
Great. Thank you. Good luck.
I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.